We ask to see the sticker on the back of your student card to ensure you are a valid student. We have an amazing team of volunteers to welcome you and answer any questions you may have. To donate, you can e-transfer controller at ams.queensu.ca with the subject line AMS Food Bank Donation, or bring non-perishables to our location during the service hours. Also check out the Pay What You Can Peach Market, providing equal access changing hunger, in the new medical building for fresh soup and entrees on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. For any questions, please reach out to foodbank@ams.queensu.ca.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
You know, one soldier's going to go down in the fight, and there's a ton more soldiers being produced every day in all of these campaigns and all of the training programs, and I do think that they're going to win, ultimately, because people have had it with capitalism in 2024.
Today in this Labor Day special, we remember the longtime labor organizer and scholar Jane McAlevey. She died in July at the age of 59. She dedicated her life to empowering rank-and-file workers, training tens of thousands around the world to effectively strengthen their unions. She gave one of her last interviews to Democracy Now! Then, United Auto Workers President Sean Fain's fiery address to the Democratic National Convention.
So for us in the labor movement, it's real simple. Kamala Harris is one of us. She's a fighter for the working class. And Donald Trump is a scam.
But first, we remember Mother Jones. All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is Labor Day. We begin today's holiday special with highlights from a production of Howard Zinn's Voices of a People's History of the United States, where Howard Zinn introduced dramatic readings from history. We'll hear Alfre Woodard read the words of labor activist Mother Jones and Howard's son Jeff Zinn read the words of an IWW poet and organizer, Arturo Giovannitti. But first, the late great historian Howard Zinn.
The IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, was a radical labor organization of the early 20th century. It organized all workers, black, white, men, women, native-born, foreign, skilled, unskilled, which the American Federation of Labor refused to do. Its goal was revolutionary, to take over the industrial system and run it for the benefit of the people. When immigrant women in the textile mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts, went on strike in 1912, they were met with police violence and judicial intimidation. The IWW poet and organizer, Arturo Giovannitti, was arrested on spurious charges for murder. Here is his speech to the jury, which found him innocent.
Mr. Foreman and gentlemen of the jury, it is the first time in my life that I speak publicly in your wonderful language, and it is the most solemn moment in my life. There has been brought only one side of this great industrial question, only the method and only the tactics, but what about the ethical part of the question? What about the better and nobler humanity, where there shall be no more slaves, where no man will ever be obliged to go on strike in order to obtain 50 cents a week more, where children will not have to starve anymore, where women no more will have to go and prostitute themselves, where at last there will not be any more slaves, any more masters, but just one great family of friends and brothers. They say you are free in this great and wonderful country. I say that politically you are, and my best compliments and congratulations. But I say you cannot be half free and half slave. And economically, all the working class in the United States are as much slaves now as the Negroes were 40 and 50 years ago. Because the man that owns the tool where another man works, the man that owns the house where this man lives, the man that owns the factory where this man wants to go to work, that man owns and controls the bread that that man eats, and therefore owns and controls his mind, his body, his heart, and his soul. I am 29 years old. Not quite. I have a woman that loves me and that I love. I have a mother and father that are waiting for me. I have an ideal that is dear to me that can be expressed or understood. And life has so many allurements, and it is so nice and so bright and so wonderful that I felt the passion of living in my heart, and I do want to live. Whichever way you judge, gentlemen of the jury, I thank you.
In the year 1914, 1,000 miners with wives and children who had gone on strike against the Rockefeller-owned coal mines in southern Colorado were holding out in a tent colony near the tiny hamlet of Ludlow. One day in April, the National Guard, financed by Rockefeller, began pouring machine gun fire into the tent colony and then came down from the hills and set fire to the tents. The next day, the bodies of 11 children and 2 women were found, suffocated, burned to death. This became known as the Ludlow Massacre. Mother Mary Jones, 82-year-old organizer for the mine workers, had come to Colorado to support the miners. And on the eve of their strike, as they gathered in the opera house in Trinidad, she spoke to them.
What would the coal in the mines be worth if you did not work to take it out? The time is ripe for you to stand like men. I know something about strikes. I didn't go into them yesterday. I was carried 84 miles and landed in jail by a United States Marshal in the night because I was talking to a miners' meeting. The next morning I was brought to court, and the judge said to me, "Did you read my injunction? Did you understand that the injunction told you not to look at the miners?"
In the summer,
as long as the judge who is higher than you leaves me sight, I will look at anything I want to, said I. The old judge died soon after that, and the injunction died with him. At another time, when in the courtroom, the bailiff said to me, "When you are addressing the court, you must say your honor." "I don't know whether he has any or not," said I. Someone said to me, "You don't believe in charity work, mother?" "No, I don't believe in charity. It is a vice. We need the upbuilding of justice to mankind. We don't need your charity. All we need is an opportunity to live like men and women in this country. I want you to pledge yourselves in this convention to stand as one solid army against the foes of human labor. Think of the thousands who are killed every day, and there is no redress for it. We will fight until the mines are made secure and human life valued more than props. Look things in the face. Don't fear a governor. Don't fear anybody. You pay the governor. He has a right to protect you. You are the biggest part of this population, the biggest part of the population in this state. You create its wealth. So I say, let the fight go on. If anybody else, nobody else will keep on. I will.
That was Alfre Woodard reading the words of labor activist Mother Jones as part of a live reading of the late great historian Howard Zinn's Voices of a People's History of the United States. When we come back, we remember the longtime labor organizer and scholar Jane McAlevey. She died in July at the age of 59.
I've been thinking about
talk about greed.
I've been thinking about
talk about greed.
I've been wondering
about greed.
Trying to find a way
to talk about greed.
Greed is a poison rising in the land. The soul of the people twisted in. Seeking out everyone. Greed never stops and work is never ever done. A creeping, choking, killing, invading everywhere. There is really no escaping greed's sneaky snare. I've been trying to think about how to talk about greed. I've been trying to think about how to
talk about greed.
I've been wondering if I could sing about
greed.
Trying to find a way
to talk about greed.
Not partial to gender or your sexual desires. All it wants is for you to want to own, to possess, and to buy. Nothing seems to stop it once it enters your soul. As you buy anything, spending out of control. I've been trying.
Greed, performed by Sweet Honey and the Rock in our Democracy Now! Studios back in 2003. The group's founder, Dr. Bernice Johnson Regan, died in July at the age of 81. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this Labor Day special, we turn now to remember the longtime labor organizer and scholar Jane McAlevey. She died in July at the age of 59 of multiple myeloma. McAlevey dedicated her life's work to empowering rank-and-file workers, training tens of thousands around the world to effectively strengthen their unions. She was also a prolific writer and the author of four books, including Rules to Win By, Power and Participation in Union Negotiations, and A Collective Bargain, Unions Organizing and the Fight for Democracy. In April, she came into Democracy Now! Studios to give one of her last interviews. Shortly before she joined us, Jane had announced she was stopping all work to turn to home-based hospice. She spoke to us just after Volkswagen workers at a Chattanooga, Tennessee factory voted overwhelmingly to unionize in a historic victory for the United Auto Workers. I began by asking Jane McAlevey about the significance of the UAW victory.
Yeah, because it's such a great story. I mean, you had 4,300 auto workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, on their third try. Honestly, they should have had a union there 10 years ago, 6 years ago. But this win wasn't just a win. It was what we would call a beatdown, honestly. I mean, they beat the employer 72%. The numbers are astounding. So part of what was so great about it is they showed in Chattanooga a lot of what I have been talking and writing and practicing about for decades, which is they had a supermajority strategy. They said they wouldn't file for election until they had a what we call a supermajority of the workers engaged on public petitions saying we're ready to vote yes. And when you lead with a public petition that says, we're ready to vote yes, you are signaling to the employer, we're coming to get you. And that's exactly what they did. They were having parties. They were having T-shirt parties. They were walking around in red T-shirts in that plant for weeks leading up to the election. They were messaging all the things that those of us who win really hard campaigns, and I don't know any campaign anymore that isn't hard, It's all the stuff that we do. Those of us who have just kept winning in the last 40 years while too many national labor leaders sat around debating, we can't really win. We have to change labor law. We have to do all these things, when all we have to do is actually start trusting that workers are really intelligent, that if we teach them what it takes to win, which is building super majority organization before the election, that's going to carry them into a great first contract fight. And that's just what they did in Chattanooga.
And I wanted to ask you about the role of Sean Fain here. He spoke at a Labor Notes conference. For people who are not familiar with Labor Notes, this is the organization that has been backing rank and file movements for decades. And to have a UAW president speak at a Labor Notes conference in itself is highly unusual. I'm wondering your sense of the impact of the democracy movement that occurred within the UAW and its effect on the labor movement.
Yeah. I mean, this is a source of personal joy because I'm a UAW member for many years, including that I was part of the 48,000 worker strike. So I had the pleasure of voting in the ballot initiative to get direct democracy in the United Auto Workers. And then I had the pleasure of pulling the lever for Sean Fain, doing some fundraisers on the West Coast with a bunch of folks for him. So to watch him go from winning the election, contested, highly contested, basically taking over in early March, walking into what was their national negotiations, every 4 years, their national negotiations conference in late March, going into and leading a series of unprecedented strikes that resulted in incredible victories, had a direct impact on the workers in Chattanooga deciding, hey, we want some of that, right? Like, we want to top out at 40 bucks an hour instead of the low 30s that we top out at right now in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So Sean Fain is already becoming the kind of trade union leader that we need many, many more of. And I am thrilled that he is my union president. And I'm thrilled that I got to participate in the direct democracy movement that helped put Sean Fain in, because we are seeing what one risk-taking, strategic, smart trade union leader can do in literally less than a year. He's created a movement in less than 12 months.
Jane McAlevey, your incredibly strong voice doesn't convey it, but in addition to fighting for labor rights, you are battling terminal cancer in the fall of 2021, diagnosed with multiple myeloma. You recently wrote a piece titled, I Have Stopped All Work to Turn to Home-Based Hospice for the Remainder of My Time. Can you talk about this struggle?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a struggle that's basically coming to an end. I received what's called a high-risk form of multiple myeloma. Very dangerous. It's called the 414 mutation. And from day one, they said you had a handful of years to live. And I just didn't look back. I just woke up the next day and kept organizing. Because to me, while I was absolutely paying attention to my doctors, going through chemo, going through radiation, we got to the point where we had quickly run the clock on everything available to treat me. And I was moving into clinical trials. I was doing clinical trial drugs. And at this point, my cancer is ahead of the clinical trial drugs, and there is nothing left. So several weeks ago, I was hospitalized for a few weeks, kind of delirious out of it, which happens a lot in the last 3 years. I would quietly just be hospitalized and not know what was going on around me. They thought I would be dead a few weeks ago. I'm out again. I'm riding my bike. I'm on your show. And I'm going to fight until the last dying minute, because that's what American workers deserve. So what breaks my heart about having to announce hospice, even though I'm sitting here talking to you, and I will keep doing work, I'm going to try and write a little bit right now, but is I can never really stop, you know, but what it's giving me more time to do is prioritize friends and family. And I have to tell you that the life of a trade union organizer who's generally going up against what we call A-level boss fights, meaning the toughest there are, where they call in 18, 20, 25 of them, terrorize them, captive audiences, fire them, all of it. Like, every fight I've had has been that level, what we call an A-level boss fight. There's an A-level, B-level, C-level in organizer kind of lingo. You know, so for me, it's the courage of all the workers that I've had the pleasure of being with in these struggles for 20 years, where they have to get up and take risk and do things that are extraordinary just to form a union, that I think is where I take the strength I have from. So I'm definitely spending more time with family and friends. I haven't gotten enough time with them maybe over the years because the campaigns are so relentless. I think a 19-hour day was an average for most of the last 20 years. I don't think the lack of sleep has hurt my ability to heal because I keep kind of bouncing back. To me, the only worthwhile thing really to say, I think, still about the cancer is just that this time there's nowhere to go. So each time I collapsed and went down in the hospitals, they would have a strategy, right? We're strategists. I'm a strategist. I'd wake up and I'd be like, what's the next strategy? And when I came up this time, they said the strategy is hospice. Because there is nothing else to do. So I'm really enjoying time with my friends and family. I've probably seen 50 people already in just the last 2 weeks. I am so blessed by so many good friends. And it's, I would say, my tribe, I've always called them. I know it's a holiday. But, you know, there's a tribe of organizers, like 400 of us, who just kept winning in all the years that the national leadership kept saying we couldn't win. There's like 400 of us who just kept winning, whether it was the Chicago Teachers Union folks, the United Teachers, Los Angeles folks. Now we've got the Victor Ender Sean Fain. I feel like 2024 in Chattanooga is a little bit akin, and boy, if they hit Mercedes, it's really going to be true. Like 2012, when the brilliant Karen Lewis, who we lost to cancer, came on and came out and led that incredible strike at a time when
Chicago teachers.
Yeah, when big strikes hadn't been happening for a very long time, and they got ready, and they did their work, and they had the community behind them. They did incredible preparation work for 2 years to get ready for that strike. They did supermajority, same word I was using about Chattanooga. They built supermajority committees in every single school in Chicago. And when they hit in 2012 and took the country by storm, certainly took organizers by storm, we were like, what is going on in Chicago? And everyone was going to Chicago to see what the mighty Chicago Teachers Union did in 2012. That moment began to rebuild the idea that we could run big strikes and win. We could run big strikes and win. And that is what began to happen across education land. And we've had a whole hell of a lot more of them. So we know that when we do the work right, we can win. And that tribe of 400, probably 25 of whom have come zooming in to say their last goodbyes, which I try and turn into like a last cocktail or something nice in the evening with them, and really talk about the reflections and how we win. And I think for all of us, there's been this deep love across this crew of 300 or 400 of us all across the country, some of whom, by the way, were leading the campaign in Chattanooga, or helping teach the workers.
Against Volkswagen.
Yeah, against Volkswagen. Some of the tribe was in the Chattanooga fight because there are methods. There's a discipline and a set of methods that we know. And we know they don't always work. Nothing is ubiquitous, but they work a lot. And so, you know, I've almost never lost a National Labor Relations Board election in 20 years, and there's a reason for that. And there's a lot of organizers, and this is a really important thing to say. There's a lot of organizers whose names, unlike mine, no one's going to ever know. I could start naming them. They're an incredible, my comrades, my 400 or so, what we call the tribe, you're never going to know their names. And they just helped the workers. They just coached the workers into the victory against Volkswagen. They're going to be helping coach those workers what it is the boss is going to do next in that fight. You got to stay ahead of the boss in the fight under our methods. There's a way you stay ahead of the boss. We call stay ahead of the boss in the fight. And it's only because I had that first cancer. Really, I'm an accidental writer, honestly. And then Francis Fox Piven read the first draft and dragged me into the PhD to write No Shortcuts, which was also not a plan. I didn't finish undergraduate because I was arrested too many times doing student protests in my college years. I just dropped out. But, you know, there's a lot of organizers who are every bit as good as me. We're good. There's a lot of us, and we like to win, and we like to teach workers how to win. What are the methods? What is it we can do? And now we've taken that you know, we've trained 40,000 rank-and-file workers in 2.5 years since COVID started in our global training program, Organizing for Power. There's another one starting on May 7th. There's 6-week organizing courses. They're free. You have to come in teams. But I want to basically acknowledge all the organizers who are out there winning and have just kept winning and kept winning and kept winning, again, in the face almost of a cynical kind of do-nothing national trade union leadership that lost faith in workers and that didn't put the kind of resources into organizing and started hiring lawyers and did brand damage and did shareholder campaigns and did everything but talk to American workers. And it turns out when we invest our energy into actually engaging with American workers, they vote yes for unions. And so that team of organizers who just kept at it and are going to keep at it long after I'm dead. I love them. And they have a lot more people to teach. And we're in a hell of a moment right now. And there's also a lot of danger all around us, right? We've got Trump lurking. We've got polarization at really intense levels. And one thing I want to say about a beautiful trade union campaign, the kind that we just saw, where they won by 72%, you know, at Volkswagen, is that spreads. That kind of work actually spreads. And when you have a victory like that, other workers all around the country and the world, but especially the country, start to think to themselves, hey, we can probably do that. Like, how do we actually do that? So we've had this position of 20 years of risk-averse national trade union leaders, Sean Fain, breath of fresh air, just so different, so ready to go out there and be risk-taking and say, I have faith that American workers are smart enough to know what's right or wrong as long as we can get into a one-on-one conversation with them. You know, and they're doing it. So it's pretty amazing. And I just want to acknowledge all those organizers who are not writing books. I mean, I wrote the first book because I had cancer. And I wrote the fourth book on cancer. And to be honest, I had started my fifth book, and I'm sorry that I'm not going to get to finish it, called, I'll just say it, it's the theme of my life, but it was, to me, it was going to be my ultimate sort of final book on power, called Leave No Power on the Table. So we leave a lot of power on the table in the trade union movement. And in my view, in every campaign, there isn't room to leave an ounce of power on the table if workers want to win and have life-changing contracts like they did in the UAW settlements.
Jane, I wanted to ask you, you've alluded a couple of times to your start as a student organizer in the West from apartheid in South Africa. Could you talk about that and how that shaped your activism?
Sure. Yeah, there were two rounds of it. I mean, to make a long story short, in the State University of New York, it's 64 colleges. If you include the community colleges, 64 state colleges and community colleges. It's the largest public university system in the country. And back in the day when I was 18, 17, we had a very strong, we called it actually a statewide student union. We actually used the word student union. And people had to join. And we were going up against Young Americans for Freedom, who would run anti-dues campaigns. And we had to win the dues campaigns. I mean, it was a lot like running a union campaign, just a little bit less intense than I would find, you know, 20 years later. So as student leader, I became the elected student body president at State University of New York at Buffalo, which is the largest of the campuses. And our grad students were in with undergrads in the student government. So I had a universe of 28,000 voters and was going up against actually a really hard campaign by the athletes and the sort of Greeks who were like, who's this left winger who's going to try and take student government? We took every seat. We ran 28 people. We ran a slate. My father was a politician. He said, you don't just run alone. You want to govern. So you want to run a whole slate. So 28 of us ran for student senate, every single position. If there was dog catcher, we would have run someone for that. We took the entire student government. And then basically dove face first into the fight to divest the university from South Africa. And by a year later, I was elected head of the state student union, which made me the student trustee, like officially, legally the student trustee, on the statewide board, which gave me access to documents, to all the financial records, to every single thing a board of trustee member gets. So very unusual that you had a powerful enough state student union that the president was actually a member of the board of trustees. And to make too many long stories short, we had already introduced a divestment resolution several times before I became the president, and we made a few strategy changes. One was we began to focus much more on Mario Cuomo. Mario. Smarter, I believe, than the son. But anyway, Cuomo wanted to run for president, too, and we decided we had to start shifting strategy and putting pressure on Mario Cuomo, this, like, lovely Democrat who was going to run for office. And we said, hey, you know, you're the real governor of, in some ways, the State University of New York system, and we're going to put this campaign on you, Mr. Liberal Democrat who wants to run for president. We're going to put South Africa, Nelson Mandela's arrest, the murder of people all over South Africa, and apartheid directly onto your lap if you don't start getting involved in the campaign. The day of the fourth vote, which was my first vote as a trustee, we introduced the resolution, but I had access. I had the swipe pass to get in to the back because I was a trustee. So I wore a very large skirt that was covered with chains underneath it and padlocks. And step one for me was to get up, introduce the resolution. Predictably, they were going to vote it down. And then I was going to take a bathroom break, which I did, and went downstairs. So there were actually hundreds of workers secretly waiting. And we took the business office because we wanted to stop the state business immediately, like, so that the university couldn't function. So we had hundreds of students ready to take the finance office of the whole state university system, not just one campus. We shut it down. It was a pretty intense moment. Actually, we had to ask all the nice secretaries, we love you, but we recommend you leave now before we padlock the doors. And that campaign led to the biggest divestment in the history of the divestment movement at that time. We really drew it out. They overreached. They put me in jail along with two other student leaders. I mean, imagine me at 19, like, being sent off to jail. That wasn't very smart of them. That's when you learn a boss doing an overreach. We had the ANC testifying in our trial. We, like, made it into a trial. We're like, you're going to put us, you're going to actually charge us with real charges, the three leaders, me and two others. And we said, strategy, right? Like, my father, again, being the daughter of a politician, was helpful, a left-wing politician, was helpful, because I went to strategy. So they're arresting us. No one else is getting arrested on charges that are going to put us in jail. We're going to go to jail. Let's take the trial. So they tried to settle an agreement with us outside of court and say, if you agree to never protest for your time as a student leader, we'll drop the charges. And I said, oh, hell no. You're not going to stop me from protesting on college campuses. I'm like the state student leader. And as soon as we said no, we had a trial.
And Jane, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the how the changing nature of production and work in the United States has affected the ability of organizers to organize workers, because clearly more and more factory production is shipped overseas, and the employers go from big industrial operations to smaller ones. They try to contract out aspects of their work as much as possible to reduce class consciousness. How that has affected the ability of organizers in the United States to continue to build worker power?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think two things. One is, I mean, everyone who has continued to try to organize, and even the folks who are doing sort of mobilizing work, which to me, again, is secondary in its effect. But everyone trying to win for the last, since I'd say 1995, when the change happened at the AFL-CIO, when John Sweeney took over back in 1995, that's sort of when I enter. Everyone who's been trying since then knew that two things were true, or they knew at least one thing was true. One is we had to look for strategic targets who could not be forced out of the U.S. Hence, I become a hospital organizer, right? They still have yet to figure out how to have a registered nurse administer the kind of incredible care I'm getting from Vietnam, China, fill in the blank. Yet, When that's going to happen, who knows? But so we all spent the last 20, 25 years looking for strategic, keyword, targets where they could not move the workers out of the U.S. And that's part, so that's one. Two, in order to win in those kind of campaigns where, Juan, the numbers became smaller, you know, a hospital, the larger hospitals that I've helped organize were 2,000 or 3,000 at a time, which is a nice number, 2,000 or 3,000 workers in one election and going into negotiations. But a lot of them are smaller. A lot of it's nursing homes. A lot of it's, I mean, at the smallest, you can see a Starbucks, you know, 20 workers or so. But a lot of the targets, the strategic targets, became smaller. So I think we had to do a strategy adjustment, which was how can we build deep community support around these workers? How can we aggressively and strategically, quietly change the conditions that are going to make it so that healthcare workers, for sake of argument, or educators, actually build really intense relationships that are genuine with the people who are going to be the first ones who might have turned their back on them when they walk out on strike, demanding both better schools, better healthcare systems, better staffing ratios. All of those, I call that mission-driven workers. That's a lot of my work has been in what I call the mission-driven worker field. And those workers have incredible capacity to recruit the whole community to their side. Now, not enough unions do it, honestly. Like, not nearly enough trade unions make real connections between the workers and the campaign and the workers' own community. I sort of probably became known for that, second to the debate about organizing versus mobilizing, for very deliberately in every campaign I've ever run. First, we chart the workplace, what's called charting the workplace. We make sure we have all the correct leaders identified. The leaders are leading all of their coworkers into struggle. Because in the private sector, right, no staff can go in. This is all about the workers. Like, the rank-and-file workers have to run these campaigns because it's the private sector, which is where I've spent my life fighting. You know, we get arrested if we put our toe on the sidewalk. So the essence of a good trade union organizer in this era has been we're teachers, we're coaches. We have to teach the workers everything. They actually have to execute their own campaigns. And that's been true in every fight that I've had the pleasure of leading. So once we have a majority built inside of a workplace, a nursing home, a hospital, fill in the blank, we then begin to chart very systematically. These are real words, charting, I'm using. We chart the workers' connections to their faith leaders. Do they have a house of faith? Are they involved in the PTO? Are they involved in a local food bank? Do they volunteer to coach Little League or sports? Like, every worker has a ton of connections in their own community. And we systematically chart them. There's probably five of us in the country who do this at the level I'm talking about. They're in Chicago Teachers Union, too, by the way, like who really dig in to show that the workers themselves can bring a whole new third front for power with them into the fight. And it's been essential, frankly, to beat down the union busters in these kind of campaigns in the era when it's easier to offshore jobs. It's going to be true in Chattanooga, too. They're going to have a hell of a community campaign around around the workers, the 4,300 workers who we should keep celebrating as they go into their first contract negotiations, right? Remember, in the U.S., round one is winning a hard-as-hell election where people are being terrified and terrorized daily and fired and all sorts of things. And part two is winning the first collective agreement, which is why I wrote the fourth book. And again, sorry, I'm not going to get to Leave No Power on the Table, the fifth book. But the fourth book...
You might.
I'm happy. Well, I'm happy. I'm really happy to have gotten the fourth book out on negotiations because I think it's the most radical change that a union can make overnight. I was taught to let all workers into the negotiations process. Most unions bring a lawyer, a couple elected leaders. Maybe there's five people in the room total. This is 95% of American labor, and I'm not kidding. That's how negotiations happen. For those of us trained in a much more militant and democratic 1930s, 40s tradition, we bring all the workers. And I literally want all the workers, like anyone who's not on shift, should be in negotiations on days that we negotiate. So hundreds of workers are who the boss confronts when they walk into a room if I have the pleasure of being the chief negotiator. And leaving that book to America's workers, if you read nothing else, reading that book is a game changer. Because when workers themselves see their employer across the table behaving like a total ass and trying to explain why what we heard on the Moody's and Porter's call about how many billions they're about to make, and they're telling us, oh, sorry, poor us, pockets are empty, we got no money. It's like my favorite negotiation session is when we've shown the workers the real numbers that they're telling their investors. You know, the corporations that we're fighting, they're all big private sector hospitals now, too. They're not little hospitals, mom and pops. These are huge corporations that own all these hospitals, mostly in the South, because they're union busters. And then we bring in 300 workers for the day that we're going to force the chief financial officer into negotiations, because you can do that when you have a union. You can actually say someone has to come explain the financials you gave us. Non-union workers don't have the right to the company's financials. Unionized workers do. So those are always some of my favorite sessions on capitalism. I don't even have to say the word capitalism. This is today's lesson in how capitalism works. They lie to you through their teeth, literally, about how much money there is, and then they get up and walk out of the room. And usually, pretty much from that negotiation session on, it's a game changer. And in all of those fights, if you look at a successful campaign, the number one thing we're trying to do is build, first identify the most trusted worker leader, and then start building the confidence of the workers that they deserve a good health care plan. They deserve better pay. They deserve a real vacation, not just paid time off. They deserve a quality of life. That's allowing their CEOs to go live on yachts and play with rockets. So that's some of the difference. And there were a lot, you know, there were a lot of differences. So the reason why Power and Participation, that book, and maybe No Shortcuts really matter is that we're going to have to be running a lot of illegal strikes. They're coming. So if we've got risk-averse national union leaders who are scared to do strikes right now, I just want to say, time to get over it. Because risk, we're not going to have time for risk aversion. If we do our work right, if we get public petitions, what we call a public petition, where 70, 80, 90% of the workers say, I'm ready, whether that's illegal or legal, we're going to have to start walking. Because in the near future, strikes will be illegal, or they will charge so much money as to have the effect, as to make them illegal. So it's nothing shy of 100% and 95% walkout, united, strong, and together with their community, with them, is going to be able to win. People need to start practicing that right now, building supermajorities, winning like they did in Volkswagen, and a lot of other places where people are fighting elections every day. So we've got to get on it in terms of teaching people. You don't take risk lightly and stupidly. You take it based on a set of assessments and a set of tests you've done as organizers with the workers, that the workers know every single assessment they're doing. And when they've got 95% of people T-shirting up in the same color and walking out and having a party in the parking lot, you're pretty much going to win. We're going to need a lot more of that heading into a future that I think with the current Supreme Court is going to very quickly have strikes made illegal.
And yet you maintain so much hope. I just want to finally ask, as you confront your own mortality, how do you have this level of optimism, of brilliance, of lucidity, and to also offer hope to people who perhaps are in the same situation as you are, as you deal with cancer?
You know, I, Amy, feel like I've had a really great life. I have been paid for 40, because the environmental justice, the Highlander years, the student organizing that started before the trade union, the dominance of the trade union work in my life. But, you know, for essentially 40 years, I have been paid to teach workers and ordinary people how to beat the power structure and beat it hard and win a lot. And so I feel like my life, I feel like I had an incredibly fortunate life. Purposeful. Family and friends would probably complain that they haven't seen enough of me in that 40 years. That's why I'm hanging out and spending a lot more time with people right now, and that's really important to me. But I have seen so many tens of thousands of workers win against stiff odds that I kind of have endless faith in the ability of workers to continue to win. Takes methods, takes discipline. But for me, I am going to just keep cheering on every single worker in every worker campaign until the day that I no longer am with us. But I am going to hopefully keep writing as fast as I can right now on a few subjects that relate to power. And for anyone who's in a cancer fight, you know, it's a god-awful thing. It's confidence stripping. It is soul stripping a lot of days. And what's been amazing for me is the team I work with, the team I've been working with on a very big campaign, in particular in Connecticut, kind of multi-year campaign, getting ready for it with a terrific union. You know, I know the work is going to continue. So that's what gives me peace of mind. The books are out. The global and the domestic training programs are solid. I've replaced myself with staff everywhere at this point. I spent all of last year doing what I called 2023 was the year of succession planning because it was January. I call it the other January 6th. January 6th of 23, when they really said, you're going to be dead in 2 weeks. And family flew in from all over the world to say goodbye. And then I popped back up again. So, again, that's different than now because they had a clinical trial drug to put me right into, which just magically worked. You know, the work is going to go on. And that's what makes me happy, is that I did a lot of succession planning. The work is going to go. And if workers just keep winning, one person falls, one soldier goes down. I've always thought of myself as a soldier. You know, one soldier is going to go down in the fight, and there's a ton more soldiers being produced every day in all of these campaigns and all of the training programs. And I do think that they're going to win, ultimately, because people have had it with capitalism in 2024.
And your advice to people who are caring for people with cancer, what is most helpful to you?
You know, showing a lot of love. Also giving space sometimes. I'm the kind of person who needs some time alone each day, which is a struggle with my incredible caretakers, though most of them really understand it. But, you know, delivering food, mostly sending messages. Like when I wake up in the morning, God, especially since I have not even yet read all of the letters I've gotten since the news about hospice, and it is unbelievable. If I'm feeling bad for a minute, I just turn and go to the next letter. I just read one from, like, I think Alyssa Barazzoni that blew my mind. Like, so just letting people know, you know, that their life has been worthwhile and that the struggle continues. I think that's what people with cancer need, a lot of love, a lot of tenderness, a lot of healthy food, a lot of fun, if you can do it. You know, we're trying to have a lot of fun. I did a book party called The Not Dead Yet Book Party when Power and Participation came out, because I was supposed to be dead then, and had two comedians, Dominique Nisperos and Nate O'Green. I don't know if you know them, but I had two comedians MC the party where I was supposed to be dead. So trying to keep it light, and then for me, really doing the succession work. But I think for a lot of people who are struggling with cancer, those who will survive, God bless, get on it, you know, do the work you need to do to recover. It's hard work and it's exhausting. And for people facing, you know, a more terminal diagnosis like mine, I think we probably need all sorts of different things. But what we definitely need is a lot of love notes, a lot of text, a lot of emails, and just a lot of support through the fight.
That was longtime labor organizer and scholar Jane McAlevey speaking on Democracy Now! In April, shortly after she announced she was entering hospice. It was one of her last interviews. She died in July at the age of 59. Go to democracynow.org to see the full interview. When we come back, UAW President Sean Fain.
He was her only child, her baby boy. She was his second daughter, a father's pride and joy. Somebody's mother, brother, best friend, sister, lover. Maybe an A1 student running, hiding, taking cover.
The women gather, crying tears that fill a million oceans. It doesn't matter where you're living. The women gather, crying tears that fill a million oceans.
People say, not in this neighborhood. It doesn't happen here. Our kids have everything. What do we have to fear? But what about the ones who say this happens every day? Drugs and violence take our children. How much more death can come our way?
The women gather, crying tears that fill a million oceans. It doesn't matter where you're living. The women gather, crying tears that fill a million oceans.
Don't you know? Some bullets find their targets. Bombs can take you right on cue. Some in the hands of babies or officials and their crew. Claimed the brother had a gun. She fit the profile in my book.
The Women Gather, performed by Sweet Honey and the Rock in our Democracy Now! Firehouse studio back in 2003. The group's founder, Dr. Bernice Johnson Regan, died in July at the age of 81. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end this Labor Day special with Sean Fain, president of the United Auto Workers. In August, he addressed the Democratic National Convention.
Good evening, America, and good evening to the people that make this world move, the working class. On behalf of 1 million active and retired members of the UAW, I am honored to support Kamala Harris and Tim Walz to be our next president and vice president. And I want to say thank you to Joe Biden for making history by walking the picket line with the UAW. For the UAW and for working class people everywhere, this election comes down to one question. Which side are you on? On one side, we have Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, who have stood shoulder to shoulder with the working class. On the other side, we have Trump and Vance. Two lapdogs for the billionaire class who only serve themselves. So for us in the labor movement, it's real simple. Kamala Harris is one of us. She's a fighter for the working class. And Donald Trump is a scab. That's not just my opinion, that's a fact. All we have to do is look at the track record. When Donald Trump was president, corporate America ran wild. Donald Trump did not bring back the auto industry. When Donald Trump was president, auto plants closed. Trump did nothing. Trump told workers in Lordstown, Ohio, that he would be bringing all the auto jobs back. And Trump did nothing. In 2019, General Motor workers went on strike for 40 days for good jobs and a better life. And Trump did nothing. Talk is cheap. But in 2019, You know who was on the picket line standing shoulder to shoulder with auto workers? I'll give you a clue. Her initials are Kamala Harris. In 2023, who helped bring jobs back to Lordstown, Ohio? Kamala Harris. And in 2024, who will stand with the working class in our fight for justice? Kamala Harris. And that's the difference. Donald Trump is all talk, and Kamala Harris walks the walk. Woo. In the words of the great American poet, Nelly, it's getting hot in here. It's hot in here because you're fired up and you're fed up, and the American working class is fired up and fed up. The American working class is in a fight for our lives. And if you don't believe me, just last night, blue-collar workers, the UAW members at Cornell University had to walk out on strike for a better life because they're fighting corporate greed. And our only hope is to attack corporate greed head on. Corporate greed turns blue-collar blood, sweat, and tears into Wall Street stock buybacks and CEO jackpots. It causes inflation. It hurts workers. It hurts consumers. And it hurts America. And corporate greed is alive and well in the auto industry. You know, last fall, we achieved life-changing gains in our strike at the Big Three. We even won a commitment to reopen a closed plant not too far from here. We were able to do that thanks to the support of Kamala Harris and Joe Biden and the thousands of auto workers that went on strike. But a year later, one company wants to go back on their commitments in our contract. And let me be clear, Stellantis must keep the promises they made to America in our union contract. And the UAW will take whatever action necessary at Stellantis or any other corporation to stand up and hold corporate America accountable. And when the UAW stands up, we know who stands with us and who stands against us. Donald Trump laughs about firing workers who go on strike. And Kamala Harris stands shoulder to shoulder with workers when they're on strike. And that's the difference between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump the scab. Trump is pushing divide and conquer tactics of the rich. It's the oldest trick in the book. They want to blame the frustrations of working class people. They want to take those frustrations. They want to blame it on race. They want to blame it on LGBTQ plus people. They want to blame it on some destitute and desperate person at the border. They do that because they want working class people to be divided and to focus and keep the focus off the one true enemy, corporate greed. The rich think we're stupid. But working class Americans see this for what it is. This is our generation's defining moment. So I have a question for you. Are you ready to stand up, speak up, and show up and put Kamala Harris and Tim Walz in the White House? We need a defender of the working class in the White House. Someone who is one of us and someone who knows how to fight. And that fighter is the next president of the United States, Kamala Harris. Thank you.
That was Sean Fain, president of the United Auto Workers, speaking at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in August. And that does it for this Labor Day special. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharifa Dokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamariu Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
On Saturday, September 7th, the Queens Gaels will host the York Lions at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Last